in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host Vicky is unable to join us today. Still, I'm happy to be talking with Superintendent Eric Jones of the Cal Poly Maritime Academy, the only one of seven maritime academies located on the West Coast. A retired Coast Guard Rear Admiral, Eric served 13 years of his Coast Guard career at sea, where he commanded three cutters, including the three-masted Bark Eagle, known as America's Tall Ship. He has a number of honors and degrees, including in marine architecture, business, and mathematics. He also has an unlimited tonnage Master Mariner credential, which means he can captain pretty much anything that floats. But his immediate job challenge is overseeing the integration now taking place between Cal Maritime in Vallejo and Cal Poly at San Luis Obispo, one of the state's top technical schools. This transition will also include a new training ship coming to Vallejo in 2026. But before we get into all of that, Eric, let me ask you what we ask most of our guests, which is, what was your first connection with the ocean?
Hey, David, good morning, and thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to see you again. I'm sorry to miss Vicky this time around. But my first connection to the ocean, I grew up in Half Moon Bay, California, and in my early teens, I worked in a little greasy spoon restaurant there in Pillar Point Harbor. And when the restaurant was bought out to establish a seafood market, my dad was already looking around, being the Vietnam Marine he was, and he noted that the restaurant's owner, her husband, owned a headboat company, Pillar Point Fishing Trips, in the harbor. And he basically asked me to check and see if they'd have a job. And so I went to one of the owners of Pillar Point Fishing Trips. And since I was already used to being up at 4 in the morning to feed the fishermen at the Sea Witch, when they told me I just needed to be in the bait shop by 4:30 to go out and deckhand on the boats, it made an extra 30 minutes of sleep, and then ended up between then and turning 17 working on both headboats, both for sport fishing and whale watching, and also some commercial boats as well.
So you were already pretty saltwater saturated by the time you graduated high school. What did you do next?
I loved working on the water. The skippers of the headboats basically said, "You don't want my job." And so they pointed me, they said, "Look at Cal Maritime Academy." And by looking at Cal Maritime, I also found out about the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. And so those were my two lead schools when I was applying to college. But I had a little bit of a turn when I was 17. I got caught on one of the headboats that was flooding. The engine room was flooding, and that's a much longer story. But safe it to say, the boat never sank. Everyone was okay. But the Coast Guard had an investigation after that incident happened. And I met a 24-year-old Coast Guard Lieutenant Junior Grade as part of that process. And he took me to his 82-foot patrol boat out of Yerba Buena Island. And here he was, a 24-year-old in command of his own boat, crew of 11. And then he told me about the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. And when I ordered the catalog of courses, there on the front was a picture of that painting from Opsail 76 with the Bark Eagle leading the parade of sail into New York Harbor. And I was hooked. I quickly applied to the Coast Guard Academy and was fortunate to be accepted. And so I graduated in 1987 from the Coast Guard Academy.
And had, like many Coasties, a very varied career. You can take command very young, which first got you interested, and go in all sorts of directions. At one point, you were commanded District 7, which is now called Southeast Command, which includes all of Florida, the Caribbean, and one of the most active places in terms of migrant and drug interdiction. You had hurricanes and hurricane response. You have lots of drunken boaters down there. What was that like?
Boy, there was never a quiet day in District 7. Again, as you said, now Coast Guard Southeast District. Some of the highlights, or I guess you should say, some of them were not great highlights, but
dramatic moments.
Yeah, dramatic moments. Thanks for putting it that way. Yeah, we did have, very shortly after I got there and we started the 2019 hurricane season, Hurricane Dorian came in and hit the Bahamas. And as most of those people that remember Dorian, sat as a Cat 4, Cat 5, right on Grand Bahama Island for about 28 hours. And so we were the first responders in there with our helicopters, some of our fast response cutters, and the national security cutter, James. And we were there able to provide initial response, move people around the islands for medical treatment until U.S. Northern Command, the Brits and the Dutch were all able to come in and help out with the response there. And just as we were wrapping up in the Bahamas with our immediate response and moving to recovery, we had the car carrier Golden Ray capsize in Georgia's Brunswick Sound off St. Simon's Island. And that ended up being a salvage operation that went on for over a year. And because of the way she fell over, she could not be parbuckled back into the channel and instead had to be demolished. Thank goodness the pilot that was on board acted very quickly to have the tugs push the ship out of the channel. And we were able to have some pretty daring coasties, one boat crew from underneath on the port bridge wing and a helicopter crew landing on the starboard bridge wing to get all the bridge crew safely off the ship. And within 36 hours, we were also able to help oversee a cutting into the engine room to safely rescue the four Korean engineers that were in that engine room.
So a lot of high-risk activity to serve and protect others. And of course, Coast Guard has a long history of effectively intercepting go fast drug boats in the Caribbean and stopping them and arresting and bringing the drug runners to justice, which under the Trump administration, they're now blowing up and killing these people instead. So that's something that we and a lot of other people are not thrilled with and probably is breaking all the laws of war. But moving on, we've got another part of your career that's really exciting to me. And I think a lot of people, as I said, we just recently acquired a 1934 motor sailor, kind of classic boat, but there's nothing as classic as America's tall ship, the Eagle, and you were skippering it for a number of years. So first, you know, it was kind of war booty. Maybe you could describe a bit of its history and what it is, what the Eagle is.
Absolutely. For folks on the West Coast, you know, they had a rare treat this last summer. Eagle was on the West Coast. It turns out it's about three times the trip to get Eagle to the West Coast as it is to have her sail across the Atlantic to Europe. And so she only is able to get over every 10 to 20 years.
Wow.
But Eagle is a 295-foot steel square rigger, somewhat fashioned after the windjammers of the late 19th century with the nitrate trade and case oil trade. And she was built, she's one of five sister ships, but they were built during the period between World War I and into the beginning months of World War II, so that Germany could still train naval officers without warships. And so she was built and launched in 1936. She's hull number 508 out of the Blohm & Voss shipyard in Hamburg. And it turns out that the very next hull, 509, was the battleship Bismarck, because that was right as Hitler was coming to power and was moving away from the Treaty of Versailles unilaterally. So in 1946, when the Allies were divvying up the spoils of the war, Germany did have these training ships in her harbors, and the Horst Wessel became one that became available to the U.S., and at the time, the U.S. Navy was not interested in a sailing ship. The Coast Guard, however, had just enjoyed a renaissance of sail training because the Danish square rigger Danmark, a full rig ship, had requested asylum in the United States at the opening months of the war as Germany invaded Denmark. And while we couldn't grant asylum at the time because we were neutral, there was a deal struck that if the Danmark was willing to train Coast Guard Academy cadets, she certainly could remain in New London to refit during the winters. And so for the years, the Danmark was the training ship for the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. And so at the end of the war, there was high interest in getting one of the square riggers, and Horst Wessel became the one that we were able to get. Commander Gordon McGowan and five other Coasties were the original crew to go over to Bremerhaven to outfit the ship. And it's a great story if anyone ever wants to read The Skipper and the Eagle by Gordon McGowan. It's a great telling of how, by hook or by crook, they pulled together the supplies they needed and sailed her back to the U.S. with a half U.S. Coast Guard, half German Navy crew.
Wow. So the Danes got their tall ship back, and we got the Eagle, and it's always based in New London. And tell us just when you were skippering it, like, where'd you go and what the role is in terms of training cadets and what they do on board this tall ship?
Great, great question. From my background, I was fortunate that when I taught at the Coast Guard Academy, I was able to spend my summers, in the summers of 92, 93, 94, I was the navigator on board, and then I was the executive officer or the chief mate in 96 and 97 before becoming captain from 2009 to 2012. Eagle is basically the best leadership laboratory you could have because you can take 140 cadets out, roughly 20 upper-class cadets and 120 underclass cadets. And you have your upper-class cadets working in senior enlisted junior officer roles overseeing the operation of the ship under the mentorship of the permanent crew and academy faculty and staff that come aboard to help out. And the underclass cadets who have just finished their first year, they get to learn the roles of the junior enlisted. And so you've got 139 lines controlling 23 sails. The cadets have to learn all those lines. Even the helm is manual powered. The only mechanical you have is the engine, which can propel the ship about 12 knots. Under sail, she can get up to about 18 knots. And so the cadets work as a team, and they're able to tack and wear, which is wear is the square ship version of a jibe. And they set sails, douse sails, furl the sails for weather.
And they're literally, as we've seen, going up in the rigging to drop the sails.
That's exactly right. Out on the yardarms, furling the square sails. I mean, it really is. It becomes one for all these very talented young men and women from all over the country. It's a chance for them to really learn teamwork in a challenging environment. And then there's a personal crucible to get up into that rigging to help handle the sail. And we, now some would say, my gosh, this is archaic. Why in the world would you do this? Well, we are still teaching all the modern day elements of seamanship. They're learning damage control, firefighting, flooding control, that type of thing. They're learning how to trace engineering systems because you still have all the systems you have on a much larger ship, the hotel services and the like. They're learning food preparation and all the cleanups and maintenance of the ship that needs to be done, the painting. They're learning navigation, including the use of electronic charts and ECTIS systems. They're getting firsthand exposure to the weather because we stand the watch outside. There is no shelter other than a small pilot house that protects the radar, not necessarily the watch standers. And they're rotating through all those positions in the course of their 1 week aboard as a freshman, 5 weeks as a sophomore, with opportunities as a junior or a senior to go back aboard in one of those leadership positions.
What is Rising Tide? Rising Tide is Blue Frontier's bi-weekly half-hour show that features a diversity of ocean voices from the famous to the fascinating. Deep-sea explorers to whale wranglers, Arctic residents to climate justice warriors. With public broadcasting under attack, Blue Frontier offers Rising Tide and all associated content for free to community and public radio stations across the nation. We need your support to keep producing our salty, in-depth conversations. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help us keep getting the word out about our awesome blue planet. And now, back to the show.
So one of my disappointments when I was writing Rescue Warriors, I was offered to get on board the Eagle from Colombia, the nation of Colombia, up to Florida, but I figured 3 weeks at sea couldn't really justify what would probably be three paragraphs in the book. But where did you take it? These are extended cruises you take these young cadets.
I had the fortune. So when I picked the ship up in 2009, I met her in Bermuda just as she was coming back from a trip to the Mediterranean. And I brought her. We did the change of command in Charleston. And then the rest of that summer, we worked our way up the East Coast all the way to Halifax, which was really enjoyable. 2010, we met the fleet of tall ships that had just circumnavigated South America in Cartagena, Colombia.
Wow.
So all the tall ships from Central and South America, and there are a lot of them, as well as the Spanish tall ship, the Juan Sebastian de Elcano, all met together in Cartagena. And then we were able to travel together and meet again in Veracruz, Mexico, before the ship scattered to various U.S. ports. Then in 2011, we had the just wonderful opportunity to take Eagle back to Blom & Voss shipyard for her 75th birthday. So we sailed across the Atlantic, pulled into Waterford, Ireland, then made our way up into Hamburg, Germany, had a wonderful celebration for her 75th, went and visited the shipyard. And then on the way back, we made a stop in Iceland, where Eagle had never been before. And that was an opportunity also to take the crew and cadets across the Arctic Circle. And of course, this was in late June. So we didn't see any darkness for about 3 days. We never got into pack ice, but a lot of sea ice when you're up there by the Arctic Circle. And so that definitely had some folks wide-eyed as we did that. And then came back down through Halifax and into New Bedford, Massachusetts, and finally into New York. And then my final summer in 2012, that was a celebration of the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. Uh-huh.
So did you confront any British tall ships?
Yeah, thank goodness. You know, the British love to just point out the fact that, well, it was more of a sideshow to what was going on with Napoleon in Europe. So they sort of giggled about the significance we were putting on it.
You're in a unique position in that I think that you may be the only person that you were assistant superintendent at the Coast Guard Academy, and now you're superintendent at one of the Merchant Marine Academies. So obviously, one's uniform military and the other is to train maritime officers. But what's the basic difference you're seeing between the Coast Guard Academy and a maritime academy?
Great question. Yeah, as you mentioned, Cal Poly Maritime, as we now call it, because we've integrated with Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, is one of the 6 state maritime academies. And if you add the Federal Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point, you have 7 maritime academies. And these are the schools where the students, the majority of students, some of the academies, including Cal Poly Maritime, have traditional students as well as a core of cadets. And in 4 years, you basically are able, for your students who are in the licensing programs, either deck or engine, you basically are able to produce a third mate or a third assistant engineer of unlimited tonnage to join your ocean-going fleet. And so it's a really rigorous program. And we have a corps of cadets to help build the professionalism. I'd say it's more about professionalism than military, But to build a professionalism for those habits for these young women and men that are going to go to sea, for them to learn to stand their watches, to be reliable and vigilant in making sure the ship is safely operated and navigated. And in the, at the same time, they're working toward taking their exams for that license in the core of the 4 years. They also are getting a bachelor's degree. So it's pretty intense.
The only maritime academy on the West Coast is in this period of transition now. And it's a good place to graduate from because you're pretty much guaranteed a job. I mean, there's this huge demand for skilled mariners, especially in the U.S., but facing some hard times. So what's going on now?
So yeah, no, this was a decision by the chancellor and the board of trustees of the California State University System. Cal Maritime from 1929 up through 1996 was its own school. Eventually, the decision was made in 94, and it took about 2 years to happen. It became part of the California State University System, and now it's going through another transition as it integrates with Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. But it is interesting. You've touched on all the points, and they're somewhat confounding because we saw over the last decade that enrollment here basically declined from nearly 1,100 to under 800, which makes no sense because Cal Maritime still had the highest job placement rate and the highest starting salary of any CSU campus. I'm convinced it was really an issue of just awareness, especially in a post-COVID world, where young students looking at their college opportunities didn't have someone in their family or a close family friend involved in the maritime industry. And so one of the big things we're looking for as we integrate with Cal Poly is to raise the awareness.
Outreach. It's basically the academy's hidden under a bridge, and most people aren't aware. I mean, America's mariners are a small number in terms of the global mariner population, and there's a lot of restrictions. We're a great maritime nation that doesn't do a lot of shipbuilding, that doesn't encourage people to go into the careers that are lucrative and interesting, but put you at sea a lot.
We sort of use the term loosely sea blindness. Folks just aren't aware of how closely our economy is tied to the sea. In the years after World War II and the 50s, 50% of cargo tonnage that shipped around the world was on U.S. flagged vessels. Today, that percentage is closer to 0.4%. Even that said, between Kings Point and the six state maritime academies, we produce around 1,100 licensed mariners a year. The demand with folks retiring and the like is really closer to about 2,200 officers that are needed. And so there's a great demand. And as you mentioned earlier, the job prospects for a graduate are very good. And Cal Poly has a fantastic ethos of learn by doing. And that fits so well in learning the maritime trades.
You know, right. You also had a training ship at Cal Maritime that was kind of a strange looking vessel that was also housing for some of your cadets, the Golden Bear, which I guess part of this transition is you're going to get a new ship next year.
Yes. And so the Golden Bear is still our training ship. She's a former Navy hydrographic vessel. Her original name was the USNS Maury. We got her in 96. And she's been sailing ever since. As a matter of fact, the current captain, her first summer on Golden Bear was Golden Bear's second year at the academy. But we are getting...
And how big is the Golden Bear?
She's basically 500 feet long. Mm-hmm. And so the new ship, which is a national security multi-mission vessel, it will be named the Golden State. It's being built in Philadelphia at the Hanwha Philly Shipyard. We will receive the Golden State by current schedule be the third quarter of 2027. And they are wonderfully purpose-built training ships. They've got 12 classrooms and six labs on board. They've got doubled the accommodations. We go from being able to carry 300 cadets to 600 with 100 crew and faculty on board. And so extremely capable. It's only 25 feet longer, but tonnage-wise, she's about 20% larger than the Golden Bear. That also has the folks at Cal Poly very excited too, because we want to continue to look for opportunities for other students to sail. When the Golden Bear sailed last summer, they were able to take about a dozen oceanography students on board with them, not cadets, but oceanography students, who were able to basically conduct daily samples and observations in the transit from San Diego to Kauai, right through the Mid-Pacific Gyre, and were checking on the water quality, looking for microplastics. And so it was something that the entire crew was able to work with under the guidance of Professor Alex Parker. And so it was really a neat opportunity, and we want to look for those opportunities.
And let me ask you a final question, which is, you had a 36-year career in the Coast Guard. A lot of Coasties retire early in life and get a second career or get to go fishing. What attracted you to this additionally very difficult job of overseeing Merchant Marine Academy here? What was it that brought you here?
I have a love of teaching out on the water, you know, between working with Coast Guard cadets, thinking about the opportunities that working on fishing boats gave me when I was young. I have a real passion. So I was actually retired for 2 years before I came here. I did teach some high school physics and chemistry for a year, but then I took another year off, and I was sort of watching this job. And when I saw them looking for a superintendent to not only take over the Maritime Academy portion of this campus, but also to help with the integration with Cal Poly, I jumped at it. And of course, it also brought me home, because when I left San Diego in 1991, the Coast Guard kept me on the East Coast until 2023. So being able to get home to the Bay Area is really a treat for me.
Superintendent Eric Jones of the Cal Poly Maritime Academy, thank you so much for joining me today on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you, David. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.